20. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Christmas Day, 1778, evening. George Washington is in no mood to celebrate Christmas. The general has been summoned to Philadelphia by the Congress to explain his battle plans for the coming year. The Redcoats are gone, having abandoned the city to consolidate strength in New York so that a sizable number of troops could be sent to protect valuable islands in the West Indies from French attacks. London is fearful that French forces will soon attack the British stronghold of Manhattan. Therefore, the city must be defended at all costs. As Washington's army enters its second month of winter camp at nearby Middlebrook, New Jersey, Washington spends Christmas 60 miles away with Martha at the opulent mansion of Henry Laurens, a South Carolina slave trader and rice grower who has just stepped down as president of the Second Continental Congress. Footnote. The slave trading firm of Austin and Laurens, which Henry Laurens owned with his brother-in-law George Austin, brought almost 8,000 slaves into America between 1751 and 1761. The sale of these human beings made Laurens one of the richest men in America. End footnote. His presence has greatly excited the creme de la creme of Philadelphia society, and there is no lack of chauffeured carriages offloading the wealthy and privileged at the mansion's door to pay their respects and drink heartily. George Washington knows that his army is in capable hands, thanks to the stern presence of General von Steuben. Washington himself supervised the construction of log cabin barracks before undertaking the horseback ride to Philadelphia, so he is also content in the knowledge that his soldiers are not sleeping in the open. This has been the mildest winter in many years, and even though the army supply system is still deeply inefficient, there is now plenty of food and supplies for the American fighting men. There is also little threat from the British Army. Commander-in-Chief William Howe has been recalled to London, where he will soon be ordered to defend himself against charges that he abandoned General John Burgoyne at Saratoga and thus effected the humiliating British surrender that brought France into the war. Howe's successor is General Henry Clinton, a 48-year-old career officer and member of Parliament who is even more unwilling to fight than Howe, and yet he must now wage war in both the American states and the West Indies against a French foe as well as the Americans. Thus, the war has settled into a protracted engagement between an occupying force that has no intention of leaving and a rebel army lacking the firepower to evict it. Washington's only battle this year occurred in June. After all the hardship and training at Valley Forge, the lone chance to display Americans' newfound military expertise came just 10 days after the troops broke camp, on June 28, 1778, at a place known as Monmouth, halfway between Philadelphia and New York City. On a brutally hot and humid summer day, with temperatures reaching 100 degrees, Washington unleashed 5,000 men in a surprise attack on a British column commanded by Lieutenant General Charles Cornwallis. Although they do not succeed in their attempt to capture the British baggage train, the new military concepts learned under the demanding eye of Baron von Steuben allow them to thwart a vigorous British counterattack. The fighting raged back and forth until dusk, when both sides held their lines as darkness called a halt to the battle. The finale would have to wait until morning. The cool of the night was a welcome arrival. Scores lay dead on both sides, some bodies completely obliterated by cannon fire. In addition, a total of more than 100 men perished from heatstroke. The British troops were not defeated and were able to resume their march to New York City, where they arrived a few days later. But the Americans had held their own in the sort of pitched battle that had proven disastrous in previous years. Washington's troops have made an impression on Clinton. Already hampered by limited forces, he must pursue a different sort of warfare against his now much more professional foe. Besides the 8,000 troops sent to the West Indies, British troops were dispatched south by ship to invade Georgia in a tactical gambit to open a new front in the war. Not only will the capture of Savannah put another of America's major ports in British hands, it is believed that much of the southern population is loyal to the crown and will flock to join the British forces. The move places a large British force in closer proximity to the wealthy English sugar-producing colonies in Barbados and Jamaica, which are now in danger of French naval attack. Footnote: the Anglo-French naval battles in the Caribbean are an oft-overlooked offshoot of the Revolutionary War. During the summer of 1778, the French blockaded Barbados and Jamaica and seized the islands of Dominica and Grenada outright. In addition to their strategic value, Caribbean islands were a source of rum and the lucrative sugar crop. End footnote. Just 1 month ago, George Washington allowed himself to dream that the war would finally be over. "I had expectations," the general wrote in a letter to his brother John, "that the enemy were about to evacuate New York and bid adieu to the United States." That has not happened. But now, on this Christmas Day in Philadelphia, George Washington is struggling to enjoy the comforts of a big city. In the 4 years since his becoming commander-in-chief, this is his first Yuletide without fear of attack. Washington sleeps each night with Martha by his side and feasts on prime rib and succulent pig at lavish dinners that go well into the evening. There are drinks, refined conversation, and the perfumed aroma of beautiful women. Nowhere to be seen or felt is the harsh rigor or personal anxiety of Valley Forge from just 1 year ago. Still, the general cannot relax. Indeed, Washington finds the atmosphere in Philadelphia deeply troubling. All around him, people behave as if victory were a mere formality. Yet no matter what citizens believe, Washington knows independence is not assured. Soon, brutal fighting will erupt again. As George Washington walks the streets of Philadelphia, he sees the devastation the British inflicted upon it. He notices that there is an absence of trees, wooden fences, and church pews, thanks to the British reliance on burning Philadelphia's wood supply rather than venturing into rebel territory to fell a tree. The basements of many houses and city alleyways were used as redcoat toilets, and the disgusting work of cleanup is still underway. The British and their Hessian allies were fond of moving into homes and stealing furniture from nearby residences. Now the returning people of Philadelphia look for their missing belongings and return possessions that do not belong to them. Churchgoers are aghast to find their houses of worship desecrated because the British used them to stable horses. Not as visible, but far more deeply felt, are the scars borne by the women who remained behind in Philadelphia, young and old, many of them defiled by British soldiers. In some cases, even when the women were loyal to the crown, it was actual rape. In others, a choice, as British officers and soldiers frequented Philadelphia's many bordellos. Footnote: despite the fact that rape and other atrocities were hanging offenses, such acts occurred. An example is the British headquarters notation of March 14, 1778, stating that a Corporal John Fisher was sentenced to be hanged by the neck until dead for a rape on the body of Maria Nichols, a woman child of 9 years of age. Very often, however, rape was such a shameful act that women kept it a secret to avoid their own punishment. In the case of Maria Nichols, whose father was a sergeant in the British Army, she refused to share her story until exacting a promise from her own mother that if she would not beat her, she would tell. End footnote. Most of the young ladies who were in the city with the enemy and wear the present fashionable dresses have purchased them at the expense of their virtue. It is agreed on all hands that the British officers played the devil with the girls, one resident observes. The privates, I suppose, were satisfied with the common prostitutes. As George Washington begins what will become a 6-week residence in the city of Benjamin Franklin, Philadelphia's wounds haunt him, for he is a man of great compassion and well remembers what the city looked like before the British occupation. But he is just as burdened by the idleness and dissipation he sees each night in the society parties. The delegates to Congress returned from their exile in York, Pennsylvania, in June, and held their first session in Philadelphia on July 2, 1778. It is not lost on Washington that this meeting coincided with the date just 2 years ago when the vote for independence was passed, for he has not forgotten the strong character and vision of the men who signed the Declaration. Some of those delegates remain in Congress, but most new representatives are, to the general's eyes, mediocre. There is no longer a Jefferson, an Adams, a Franklin, or even a John Hancock deliberating deep into the night on the meaning of freedom. The chairs in which those great men once sat have long since been burned as firewood. Eventually, their original meeting place will become known as Independence Hall, but during the British occupation, the building was converted into a hospital for wounded American prisoners. When the enemy departed, it became necessary to scrub blood from the floors and fumigate to eliminate the odors of decomposition and filled bedpans. Footnote: conditions were so overcrowded that American soldiers awaiting treatment slept on the floor and even the stairs. Those who survived were transferred to the Walnut Street jail, where they were forced to endure the winter on a starvation diet of rats and shoe leather. The bodies of those who did not survive the hospital were tossed into a pit behind the building, along with the skeletons of dead horses and piles of trash. The aroma of decay was so vile that the returning Congress was initially unable to meet in the State House and temporarily relocated to the College of Pennsylvania on 4th and Arch Streets. End footnote. From Christmas until his departure back to his men on February 2, 1779, Washington spends his nights enduring the dreary debauchery of Philadelphia society and his days battling Congress. The delegates have authorized him to superintend and direct the military operations in all the departments in these states, but they refuse to allocate the hard currency the general needs to pay his soldiers. Washington considers this Congress the great impediment. One of the general's officers, Lieutenant Colonel Ebenezer Huntington of Connecticut, is not as diplomatic. "I despise my countrymen," he writes. "I wish I could say I was not born in America. I once gloried in it, but am now ashamed of it. You must immediately fill your regiments and pay your troops in hard monies. They cannot exist as soldiers otherwise. The insults and neglects which the army have met from the country beggars all description. And all this for my cowardly countrymen who flinch at the very time their exertions are wanted and hold their purse strings as though they would damn the world rather than part with a dollar to their army." While the rebel army is deprived, one soldier is living very well indeed. Major General Benedict Arnold has been appointed by George Washington as military governor of Philadelphia. Arnold, still bitter about his treatment at Saratoga, now lives so lavishly that many wonder if he is stealing. But Washington is not concerned. He is trying to get Arnold back on the battlefield, and granting him the governorship is a way to give the Major General's shattered leg and other wounds time to heal. Arnold's job requires him to keep the peace among Congress, the combative Pennsylvania legislature, and the Loyalists who have remained in the city after the British allies fled. This is not Arnold's ideal posting, but he has come to enjoy it very much. Prior to the war, Benedict Arnold made his living as a merchant. He is obsessed with making money. So while he entered Philadelphia in June as a soldier in need of a place to recuperate, he soon began a series of barely legal schemes to fund a lavish lifestyle. The Major General regularly issues military passes, allowing bearers to travel freely into British-occupied New York. Arnold has invested in merchant vessels and has granted the owner of the ships a special pass to transport goods from Philadelphia to the eastern seaboard, an illegal act tantamount to smuggling. Footnote: rebel military authorities did not want ships roaming the seas for fear of their being captured by the British. End footnote. He has also secretly undertaken a plan to purchase and hoard crucial supplies in the city of New York, knowing they will be in high demand once the British are forced out by the French. When necessary, he is unafraid to use his Continental Army wagons to haul goods and supplies in an effort to enrich himself. This intense focus on wealth and social status has begun to transform Arnold. He has taken up residence in the mansion recently occupied by British General William Howe and is transported around Philadelphia in a luxurious carriage. Footnote: Arnold's home was known as the Master's Pen Mansion and was located at 52430 Market Street. In addition to housing Howe and then Arnold, it would serve as the presidential mansion from 1790 to 1800, home to America's first two presidents until the White House was built in Washington, D.C. The main building was demolished in 1832, but the mansion's former location on what is now Independence Mall led to archaeological efforts to unearth the ruins. These findings, which include the site of George Washington's slave quarters during his time in office, are now an open-air museum. End footnote. He hosts elaborate dinner parties, inviting congressmen, local dignitaries, and even British loyalists to enjoy fine wine and the best food money can buy. Arnold believes the war will end soon and sees no wrong in dining with the enemy. "I flatter myself that there is a time at hand when our unhappy contests will be at an end, and peace and domestic happiness restored to everyone," he writes. The recipient of the letter bearing these words is prominent Pennsylvania Chief Justice Edward Shippen IV. Arnold has fallen deeply in love with Shippen's 18-year-old daughter Peggy. Among the beautiful socialite's prior romances was that with British officer John André, still living in Benjamin Franklin's British requisitioned Philadelphia house and now serving as Chief of Staff to General Henry Clinton. André considers Peggy a young woman of wit, beauty, and every accomplishment, referring not just to her looks, but also to her worldly knowledge of topics ranging from finance to the proper care and feeding of barnyard animals. Some of the most powerful men in America will also fall for Peggy's charms. George Washington, who dined at the Shippen home in 1774 when she was just 14, will admit to being enchanted by her beauty. And a year from now, after she suffers a fainting spell upon receiving unexpected bad news, the dashing Alexander Hamilton will race to comfort her. Yet, whether British or American, no man really knows Peggy Shippen. During the British occupation, the Shippen family, loyalists all, lived a life of apparent luxury. Nights were spent at the theater, in casinos, and dancing at the refurbished city tavern. Petite, well-read and high-spirited, Peggy was constantly the center of attention, praised for her poise and stunning good looks. But her father struggled to find the financial resources to adorn his four daughters with the latest European fashions, such as silk dresses and 2-foot-high wigs. Many men noticed. "We were all in love with her," one British officer will remember of Peggy. "She is blonde and gray-eyed, fond of laughter and society parties. On those occasions when events do not go her way, however, she is transformed, making a show of weeping loudly and refusing all food and drink for days on end." Perhaps Peggy Shippen's most profound trait is the coquette's talent for veiling her opinion. She is not only her father's youngest daughter, but also his personal favorite, sharing his loyalist views against independence. Peggy and her sisters were banished from Philadelphia society early in the war when their father was accused of being a British spy and the family was forced to flee to the countryside. The Shippens moved back to their townhouse on Society Hill as soon as General Howe captured the city and chose to remain there once Philadelphia returned to American hands, despite falling on financial hard times. Holding loyalist beliefs in a patriot citadel means Peggy must always be on her guard. The threat of betrayal and imprisonment is very real. Thus, Miss Shippen knows to keep her own counsel on matters of politics and loyalty. Footnote: The extended Shippen family, for whom Shippensburg, Pennsylvania is named, was deeply divided on the subject of American independence. Peggy Shippen's uncle was George Washington's Director General of Military Hospitals for the Continental Army at Valley Forge. His brothers-in-law, Francis Lightfoot Lee and Richard Henry Lee, famously signed the Declaration of Independence, and their cousin, Henry Light Horse Harry Lee, would not only rise to the rank of general during the Revolutionary War, but would also father Robert E. Lee, the Confederate General of American Civil War fame. End footnote. Right now, the man most beguiled by Peggy is Benedict Arnold, 20 years her senior. Amazingly, after a long parade of potential suitors, she is just as besotted, mostly by his power. There is a significant societal divide between the genteel Shippen family and the hardscrabble Arnold, but he is relentless in his determination to wed. By January 1779, there are just two obstacles to the marriage: Arnold's lack of landholdings and his limp, which makes him look weak and infirm. Arnold's shattered leg is the talk of Philadelphia society. Socialites are prone to engaging in long dialogues about its chances of a full recovery and the impact it will have on the relationship. "We have every reason to hope it will be well again," Peggy's brother-in-law observes, "but the leg will be a couple inches shorter than the other and disfigured." Soon, the governor throws away his crutches and learns to walk with a cane. Then his attention turns to buying a large estate the couple can call home. It matters not that Arnold is over his head in debt and placing himself deeper and deeper into a financial position he cannot legally maintain. His obsession for Peggy obscures all financial concerns. By the end of January 1779, the two are engaged, and Arnold is making plans to leave the military, despite the fact that his position as governor allows his business dealings to flourish. His vision is to purchase a 130,000-acre property in upstate New York, where he would become a land baron and powerful presence in civilian life. Arnold knows his young fiancée is impressed by wealth and power, and he aims to please her at all costs. On February 8, 1779, Benedict Arnold meets George Washington at the general's New Jersey headquarters. The two are cordial, with Arnold writing, "I am treated with great kindness by George Washington and the officers of the army." If Washington is concerned that one of his top generals is deeply in debt, engaging in questionable enterprises, and making plans to marry a loyalist who once dated a top British officer, he does not make this known. Instead, he continues to fervently hope that Benedict Arnold will once again become a driving force on the battlefield. But Washington is miscalculating. For Benedict Arnold is now a man of selfish pursuits, a very powerful man.